The activists building in Washington around 10 a.m. yesterday morning, they are now, I believe both of them are no longer chained. Organizer Chiara D'Angelo was locked down to the anchor chain of the support barge of the Shell Arctic drilling rig, the Arctic Challenger. She was also joined, I believe, by Matt Fuller and Cody Erdman, and they are no longer chained to the vessels. I believe there have not been any arrests, but we'll bring you updates throughout the day. Another note, thousands of people hit the streets in cities across the world on Saturday to protest against the American biotechnology giant Monsanto. And finally, in this, investigators in Fremont, California, are working to find the vandal or vandals who destroyed a dam on Alameda Creek. The dam held back approximately 50 million gallons of drinking water, which is enough. The vandals struck last Thursday morning, and they say that it was a major spill. One dam down, many more to go. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, May 25th, 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a film screening of COINTELPRO 101 Monday, June 1st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. COINTELPRO 101 is a one-hour documentary produced by the Freedom Archives explaining an illegal FBI program coined as the Counterintelligence Program, spearheaded by J. Edgar Hoover, that targeted revolutionary of the 60s and 70s. There will also be a presentation of ongoing local work and Q&A session after the film. Again, that's COINTELPRO 101 Monday, June 1st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Pacific Northwest is noted for its magnificent mountains, rivers, coastline, and verdant farmland. The region also holds itself up as a model of environmental stewardship and sustainability. Yet, at the same time, forces inside and outside of the Northwest are pushing for the region to become an export hub for fossil fuels. This morning, we talk with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about proposals to build oil, coal, and LNG terminals across the Northwest, and the opposition these proposals face from broad segments of the community. Dan, welcome to Locus Focus.
It's great to be here.
Well, we've talked a lot on this program recently about the proposed oil terminal in Vancouver, and actually the last time I saw you was at a informational meeting in Vancouver about that proposed terminal. And we've also talked about the coal terminals and sort of the falling dominoes of this plan to create a fossil fuel hub here in the Northwest. So I want to talk sort of an overview of what's happening here. Why are all these proposals on the table, and what does the fate of them seem to be?
Yeah, I mean, the short story is that we have become viewed as a sort of fossil fuel gateway. Proposed pipelines and rail routes are being seen as the sort of way to convey the middle of North America to overseas markets. So there's a whole lot of oil, gas, and coal in Montana, in North Dakota, in Wyoming, and other regions where they want to dig this stuff up. And the shortest route to those energy markets is right through the Pacific Northwest. And so I think Bill McKibben said it well a couple of years ago when he was visiting from Vancouver. He said, your geography is your destiny, and you have a disproportionate impact here in the Pacific Northwest to have an impact on climate change far beyond your actual use of energy by stopping these fossil fuel export proposals. And so that's what's going on. We're standing in the middle in this really critical choke point, and we're saying no, essentially, to all of these different coal, oil, and gas export facilities. And that includes, of course, propane.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the one that kind of slipped under the radar last fall, which was the proposed propane. It was a liquid propane terminal that they're proposing to build right on the banks of the Columbia River across from Hayden Island. It was a project by Pembina of tar sands fame or infamy, however you want to look at it. So let's talk a bit about that and how that fits into all these jigsaw puzzle pieces of the Vancouver terminal and all the coal export terminals that are planned for the Columbia River and the LNG terminals that keep popping up.
Yeah, I mean, the facilities that it most closely resembles in terms of proposals on the coast are really the LNG terminals that have been fought for 10 years. And we just heard from folks on Air Cascadia, from Jody and Sarah from Southern Oregon, who are fighting one in Coos Bay. The propane terminal is sort of similar in that it's liquid propane gas rather than liquid natural gas. So it's propane rather than methane. With that comes some differences, but the overall arc of the project is sort of the same. A lot of very densely concentrated energy in a liquid form, so cooled down to a point where the gas turns into a liquid and then stored, in this case, at Terminal 6 in Portland, very close to neighborhoods, very close to Hayden Island. And then the rail routes coming in would have carried this stuff all the way, you know, through north and northeast Portland. I think it's a real credit to the people of Portland that despite the fact that this thing seemed absolutely greased and ready to go, that people stood in the way and packed hearings and persuaded, first five planning commissioners to say no initially, and then only four. And then, of course, the city council and Mayor Hales, who had to very publicly reverse his position because of the pressure he was receiving. It fits into the overall picture because, you know, propane is part of what's being pulled out of oil to try to stabilize this oil that's being shipped or proposed to be shipped down to Vancouver, Washington. And so you can sort of imagine, you know, a case where they're pulling the propane out of the oil somewhere upstream and they're sending that on one train to Portland, and the rest of the crude oil is coming down the other side of the river to Vancouver. And, you know, it's, again, it gives you this image of the Columbia River Gorge and our entire Pacific Northwest region as sort of this gateway and this choke point. I keep using that word choke point because the gorge is so narrow and the two rail lines fall right down the middle of it. So the propane terminal is what we never really had a debate about was the sort of the impacts that are like LNG terminals, the things like, you know, closing down the river to other traffic as big LPG tankers went up and down the river, getting a real clear answer on the hazard zones around this. The Citizen Science Initiative, the folks up in North Portland, did an incredible job of essentially proposing or issuing maps that showed very clearly that not just Portland, but even downtown Vancouver is in the blast zone of that Pembina project. Or at least I shouldn't say blast zone, the hazard zone, the place where, you know, propane vapor could drift for miles and then get ignited.
But the explosion zone itself is pretty big. I mean, it included residences and schools and...
Absolutely. And they looked at, you know, the ability of the facility to throw shrapnel for literally miles. And it was a terrible, terrible idea to propose where they proposed it and anywhere. So setting aside all the climate issues of Pembina and their connection to tar sands and the safety issues and the logistics issues around that project, never got the kind of assessment that you would have expected. And those are the things that really got people interested in liquefied natural gas on the coast when they were first proposed back in 2004 and 2005. It was the idea of living in the hazard zone or living in the blast zone, of shutting down the river for this one type of big ship that's a security risk and a major hazard. And so that's one of the things that's been motivating people for 10 years on the coast. You know, it took the city of Portland several months to turn down propane, at least so far. And it's been a 10-year battle on the coast. And so that's why, as you heard earlier, there's going to be a big rally tomorrow at the Capitol, high noon, to send a clear message to our governor that we want her to kind of take heed for what Charlie Hales just did and listen to the people of Oregon who are saying no to these projects.
Well, we'll get back to that rally in a little bit later in the show. I want to talk some more about the process, this process by which these things sort of fly under the doorway when nobody's looking, it seems. And I had a conversation with Eric DePlace from Sightline Institute here on the show a few months ago, and I had just gotten an email like moments before I left my house to come down to the station about the Pembina proposal. It had just come out. And so it was kind of new to Eric, too. He had just learned about it. And it was a real surprise to a lot of people because here we were fighting the coal terminals, and the oil terminal in Vancouver had been getting an awful lot of airplay and a lot of resistance and huge number of public meetings. But suddenly this plant looked like it was a foregone conclusion that was going to be built here in Portland. So it made me think about Andrew Nikiforuk, a Calgary writer who wrote a really great book about the tar sands a number of years ago. He calls it the petrostate, and how the petrostate politics was starting to rear its head here in the Northwest. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that process and how things, political processes, change when you start being bedfellows with the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, you know, the pressure that all of these ports are receiving from fossil fuel companies, I mean, they're dangling hundreds of millions of dollars in front of ports, and they're saying, you know, we'll be your best friend. The reality is, you know, once they're in town, it's very, very difficult to dislodge them. Once you have these facilities, they carry a lot of clout. Their influence will be greater than I think you could imagine the timber industry's influence in rural Oregon. It's kind of similar. You get places that become sort of company towns.
And well, so actually, I remember when I came to Oregon, which is about 44 years ago now, timber politics permeated the entire state, including, I mean, Portland. I mean, Burnside was basically the stores where you bought your gear to go out and cut down trees in the woods. So I remember very well what it was like living in a timber state. Mm-hmm. What would you say the difference between living in a timber state and a petrostate would be?
The scale, the money, you know, it's bigger and it's dirtier. And, you know, we've seen that with the kind of influence they've been trying to wield, you know, to Soro Savage, you know, coming into Vancouver. And, you know, they got a port commission to rubber stamp a lease in July, literally weeks after an explosion killed 47 people, with the same type of train carrying the same type of oil. And
this is the explosion in Quebec.
In Lac-Mégantic, Quebec. That's right. And it's jarring to see the influence and the power. You know, Tesoro, that proposal in Vancouver should be laughed out of Washington, but they've got a refinery and they've got a lot of existing connections within the state. And we haven't gotten that clear signal from the state of Washington and their leadership that there's going to be an answer that says no to Tesoro. We're looking for that from Governor Inslee. You know, he can't speak out right now because he's kind of a judge waiting to make the call. But, you know, the state of Washington is very much in play for Tesoro and the oil industry. I think it's a real game changer. You know, we've seen, you know, former Governor Schweitzer from Montana took a junket to Longview, Washington to promote the coal export proposal there by Millennium Coal. And, you know, we keep seeing these visitors from outside of the state really pushing these projects. The impact it has on local communities is really important too, where it does become very, very divisive. Where a company like the now defunct Bradwood LNG terminal, they came into, you know, Wakayakum County, Washington, and started spreading money around, and the people who took the money were, you know, sort of scorned by other people in the community who oppose the project, and that can become very ugly in rural towns. And, you know, you heard from people from Southern Oregon earlier and on Air Cascadia, and that dynamic is playing out there now too, where essentially people are being asked to accept bribes for these really dirty fossil fuel projects. And these are projects that will fundamentally change communities for as long as they exist and forever. And that's something that I think people never fully realized about the Pembina project, just what a big deal it would have been. It was really like an LNG terminal in Portland. And that's something that it never got to the stage of people getting to really recognize how big a deal it was.
So why was it stopped in Portland in a matter of months, whereas the LNG terminals in Coos Bay and near Astoria have been being fought for 10 years?
You know, part of it is is that people got engaged at a stage where they could persuade key decision makers not to move ahead. And that's really critical. In Coos Bay and in Warrenton, where the LNG terminals on the coast have been, the companies moved very quickly and very quietly, secured leases, and started moving forward before anyone realized what LNG was. There wasn't as large and robust a movement. I think it's a real credit to the people who've been working on coal and oil and LNG for 10 years that people were ready to respond to a threat like Pembina coming in. You know, the people who are climate activists, the Climate Action Coalition and Rising Tide, the people who are engaged in all of these different arenas, you know, dealing with LNG, dealing with coal, they very quickly realized that this was another bad idea and very much cut in the same cloth or from the same cloth as the others.
Well, since the last time I talked about Pembina on this show, it was just rearing its head, and it was a lot of lack of knowledge of how it was going to go. And it looked at that time like the Portland City Council was going to approve it, actually. And I guess the Planning Commission did give it its initial nod before it went to City Council. So what happened to derail it?
Well, according to the mayor, it was thousands of people calling and emailing the mayor's office, and almost 100% of whom opposed the project. And, you know, it's a credit to everyone in Portland who took the time to go to hearings, to put pressure on Mayor Hales. Ultimately, you know, his line is, you know, we're elected to represent the people who put us here, and we're responsible to answer them. And the message Portland has sent has been very clear, that Pembina is a bad idea. And it's a bad idea for so many reasons that go beyond the climate impacts of it, which are very serious. It goes to, you know, really the core of the safety of these communities and the people who live nearby. And, you know, I think that that's the answer. It was direct citizen pressure. And you could see the Planning Commission really struggling with how to deal with, you know, what was an overwhelmingly, you know, pro-safety, pro-climate hearing is the way I would put it. It was anti-Pembina for sure. And it was all these unusual voices kind of coming together.
Now, before we went on the air, you were mentioned another reason why the Pembina proposal might have been pulled. I'm not sure if this is something you feel you want to talk about publicly.
Sure. I mean, it was in the Oregonian. So, yeah, I mean, Ted Sickinger wrote a very interesting story last week about the fact that Pembina. So the outcome of that Planning Commission hearing was that there would be a $6 million sort of climate fee placed on Pembina for all the damage it was going to do to the climate by pushing this, you know, high carbon fuel through Portland. We thought that price tag obviously was too low, and it wasn't anything that made anyone who was at the hearing think that this was a good idea, you know, who had participated in and urged them to deny it. That said, even that was too much for Pembina. And so they had signaled, along with the port, that they had no intention of paying that $6 million, and they were not going to include it in the intergovernmental agreement that was supposed to be kind of the outcome of that proceeding. So it's interesting to think about, like, what really changed Charlie's position. Was it, you know, the 4,000 people who weighed in with him, you know, in a matter of weeks? Or was it the fact that, you know, Pembina kind of changed the game and they said, no, we're not willing to do this, or the port? It's not really clear who decided it was a bad idea first, Pembina or the port. But again, you know, the fact that so many people weighed in and made climate a big issue, you know, if that ends up being what breaks it apart and protects the neighborhoods in North Portland and Hayden Island, good for us.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Sears, who is a conservation director for Columbia Riverkeeper. And we're talking about all those proposals to build coal terminals, oil terminals, liquid natural gas terminals. We've just been talking about the proposed liquid propane terminal that was proposed for the Port of Portland right across Hayden Island on the Columbia River. And we're going to talk a little bit now about liquid natural gas, which is something actually I feel like I've not devoted as much time on this show as I might have. I've been focused so much on coal and oil. But I watched very closely and with amazement at the twisting and turning of events, both in Coos Bay and in Warrenton. In Warrenton, it appeared at one time, well, first of all, to step all the way back, the original intent of the two proposed LNG terminals on the Oregon coast were to bring natural gas to Oregon, because natural gas was really expensive. It was hard to come by. It was being produced more in Asia than it was here. That was 10 years ago. So let's talk about how the landscape changed and how the purpose of these LNG terminals has also changed.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the biggest bait and switch in the history of Oregon. There were five proposals in Oregon at one time to import liquefied natural gas. So LNG is natural gas that's super cooled down to negative 260 degrees Fahrenheit. At that temperature, it gets to about 1/600th its volume, and it makes it sort of efficient, more efficient, I should say, to ship over very long distances. So it's a very dense form of energy. Once regasified, it's methane like you would burn in your home, in your natural gas burner. And so initially in 2004, these companies all came into Oregon and were seeking to import LNG and regasify it. And to be honest, we were being viewed as a backdoor to California, which uses vastly more natural gas than we do here in the state of Oregon. There were also proposals in California. Over the course of the next, you know, 4 or 5 years, the market shifted and people all over Oregon could very clearly see what was happening. And by 2009, we were calling their shot. We're saying, these aren't LNG import terminals anymore. We know that they want to use these to export LNG.
And this is all the LNG, the natural gas that was being fracked.
That's right. And so as fracking was ramping up, you know, prices in North America dropped to, you know, 1/10 of what they were paying in other places, or, you know, a small percentage. And so we were seeing there was just no market rationale for importing LNG. Despite that, both in Coos Bay and in Warrenton, these companies kept pressing forward. And we said, look, they clearly want to export LNG. We know that that's happening. The executives from the company said, no, these people are crazy. They're conspiracy theorists. You know, and I think it was in March of 2011, Bob Braddock, who's the CEO of Jordan Cove LNG, said, oh, it's a stupid idea. Speaking of LNG export, within 5 months, they had a proposal to export LNG out of Coos Bay. And so now, where does that leave us? You know, there was this movement all over rural Oregon to stop LNG imports, to stop Oregon from becoming this backdoor for importing fossil fuels from places where we really couldn't control how it was being produced, like Indonesia and Sakhalin Island, Russia, having that fuel kind of shunted through Oregon down to California.
Now, actually, my recollection was one of the big points of contention was all these pipelines that are going to be built across like Mount Hood National Forest and through the wilderness areas and things like that.
That's right.
And not to mention people's farms. Yeah. So when it switched from being import to export, those pipelines disappear. Is that correct?
Some of them. They change shape.
They change shape and they turn into trains.
That's right. Well, no. Now what we have is we still have LNG export pipelines proposed. So the pipelines remain. The Pacific Connector pipeline, over 230 miles through southern Oregon, is the same as it was for LNG import. In fact, the company's hoping to use some of the same permits that it was going to use for imports now to export LNG. The Oregon LNG pipeline changed its shape where it no longer goes through the Willamette Valley to Molalla. Instead, once it hits the border between Clatsop and Columbia County, it veers north to Woodland, Washington, and that's where it would pull gas out of the system to ship down to Warrenton. So there are still these huge 36-inch non-odorized, high-pressure pipelines proposed to snake all over the Northwest. Taken together, it's over 450 miles of new pipeline that would be used just to export liquefied natural gas from Oregon. And so that base of people, the people who are impacted by the pipelines, still remain, you know, and they're still engaged. Their voice seems to be lost now because there's so much going on in the state. There's so many other fossil fuel projects that we're dealing with that it's a challenge to keep LNG at the forefront of people's minds. But, you know, the previous administration in Oregon, Governor Kitzhaber, had took a very, very rosy view, particularly of the Jordan Cove LNG project in Coos Bay. And so what we're trying to do now is say, look, is Oregon really going to become this huge exporter of natural gas, of fracked natural gas to the world? And if that's the case, you know, Governor Brown needs to take that very seriously. And it's a decision she is going to have to make in the time of, you know, it's just sort of been plopped down in her lap. And, you know, I wish for her sake it hadn't been, that it had all been decided a long time ago that we would not do LNG in the state. But 10 years in, you know, decision time is fast approaching. The federal government, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, will likely issue licenses for both Jordan Cove LNG in Coos Bay and Oregon LNG in Warrenton. When it does that, the state is going to have to make its own decisions under the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the Coastal Zone Management Act. The state also has proprietary authority to say, no, you can't use our land, you can't use our water for this type of project. And so we are calling on Governor Brown to do all of the above and to protect these communities that have been fighting for 10 years to protect their farms and their forests and their fishing grounds. And now it's even worse than LNG import. That's the thing that's just jarring, is like we're still talking about this for an idea that only gets worse. The dredging gets bigger, the pipelines get more destructive when we start realizing what the real impacts are. And the gas is being sourced from fracking. You know, it's the most dirty, leaky way of possibly using methane, is to be fracking it out of the ground, piping it to an LNG terminal, liquefying it, shipping it across the ocean in huge tankers that burn bunker fuel, regasifying it, piping it back into a system, and then burning it. It's worse than coal. We know that now. And that's the amazing part of this story. It's 10 years in, it only gets worse.
I saw a headline this morning, which raised a big duh in my mind. It said that as increased supplies of oil are being transported through pipelines across the United States and Canada, there's an increase in spills. And this is in reference to the spill north of Santa Barbara last week. But I think the same thing could be said about pipelines for natural gas, which are also notorious for exploding and probably are, well, it's hard to say which is worse, but certainly a natural gas explosion is a really horrific thing to experience. And then, of course, there's the oil train explosions, which have been happening with alarming increasing frequency as there's more and more oil being shipped. So how do we bring that to the fore? That this is, I mean, this is an obvious, it's an obvious equation, and yet it's nice to see a headline make that connection, but what does that really mean in practice?
You know, what it means is that Oregon has a responsibility to look at all of those issues. You know, we know that the federal regulators looking at pipelines proposed through Oregon are going to rubber stamp these things. We know that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, I should say, is at least one that will say, well, those safety impacts can be mitigated. We can set those aside by saying that we'll, you know, we'll give a couple tens of thousands of dollars to these rural fire protection districts and maybe buy them a new fire truck. And like that's really the debate that's going on in rural Oregon, is these rural fire protection areas. They're saying, how are we going to deal with a fire when the block valves are 10 to 20 miles apart and it's high pressure, non-odorized natural gas burning in, say, the Clatsop or, you know, State Forest or the Columbia County State Forest, or even worse yet, in Southwest Oregon, where it's crossing through some of the most rugged coastal forests in Douglas County that, you know, that you can imagine. It's going to fall to the state of Oregon to say yes or no, and to say that the public interest is not met by doing these things, that it's in the interest of Oregonians to reject these projects under the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act or the Coastal Zone Management Act or a proprietary authority, whatever it is, whatever we choose to do. There's precedent for making that stand. You know, we saw it in the decision that Department of State Lands made about the coal terminal at Boardman, where DSL said, no, there's a real impact to the natural resources here and to a very important tribal fishery. And that caused DSL to say, no, this does not meet the standards of our removal fill law. And so we know that the state of Oregon can do this. We know the state can use its authority to say no to dirty fossil fuel projects. They did it with the Bradwood LNG project, you know, several years ago, where they said the dredging impact in this critical area for salmon is too much for us to say yes to this.
Now, what's the difference between the Bradford LNG project, which I understand is dead?
It's dead, yes.
And the new one you're talking about in Warrington?
They were always competitors. And so my favorite thing was when they would show up to hearings and talk trash about each other. but they were two different proposals for the same bad idea. Bradwood never weathered that shift from import to export. They went bankrupt. They left literally millions of dollars of unpaid bills. And, you know, that was one of the really heroic fights I've ever seen. It was really a David and Goliath struggle. And the credit for winning that fight goes to people all over the Northwest, folks from BARC who fought the Mount Hood pipeline that was going to be connected to Bradwood, people who are farmers all through the Willamette Valley who organized and got together and went to Salem, you know, brought their tractors to Salem and parked them in front of the Capitol and said, hey, you know, we're farmers and we're against LNG. The first political entity that I'm aware of that opposed LNG in the state was the Yamhill County Republican Party, which is just about as conservative as you can get. And they said, no, this is going to do too much damage to our farms, and it's just an absolute abrogation of private property rights. And so what's fascinating is to watch that coalition remain and now grow, because there are so many other issues with exporting LNG over importing it. It's not just about these farms. We're going to have to, but the stakes are much higher. The profits are so much larger that these companies are very persistent. Oregon LNG has been told no by Clatsop County, 5-0, and still they persist. Still they're saying, oh no, we think that someone else can make a decision to override that. And we never needed that permit anyway, even though they spent millions of dollars trying to get it. You know, people, 90% of the landowners along the pipeline in Southern Oregon will not work on the pipeline for LNG exports in Southern Oregon. I mean, they call themselves Landowners United. They are. They're united. They're saying no to this. And it's just, despite that, 10 years in, these companies keep pushing, because there's so much money to be made in, you know, selling gas that we buy for very cheap prices to high-priced overseas markets.
Now, with the Jordan Cove project in Coos Bay, have they actually broken ground on that?
No, they haven't. And that would be, I should say about the Jordan Cove project, the only project that makes Oregon LNG look not as bad as Jordan Cove. Jordan Cove is the worst proposal Oregon has probably ever seen. They would cross over 400 streams and rivers with the pipeline. The terminal would dredge and excavate over 5.6 million cubic yards of sediment out of a critical habitat area for salmon in the Coos Bay estuary. You know, it's remodeling Coos Bay for the purpose of exporting natural gas overseas. It's just a stunning proposal that it would even have gotten this far. It makes no sense. Literally, most of North Bend would be in the blast zone of this project. And then they have to build over a 400 megawatt power plant just to power the LNG export facility. So they'll be burning huge amounts of natural gas in a power plant on the north spit of Coos Bay just to power the LNG export facility, which will be shipping gas overseas. You know, the state of Oregon has recognized now that once the Boardman coal plant closes, not even accounting for the life cycle impacts of all that gas coming in and all that gas once it goes out, the LNG export facility at Jordan Cove would be the largest CO2 emitter or greenhouse gas emitter in the state of Oregon by 2022.
Actually, because they're emitting more methane than CO2.
In the whole life cycle, it gets even worse. And that's what makes LNG worse than coal, is that there's so much methane released during the production and transmission of natural gas. And methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas pollutant that it's actually worse than coal.
And doesn't go away as fast as CO2.
That's right. Yeah. And it eventually converts to CO2 in the atmosphere. Yeah. And it's that potent methane leakage problem and just the methane release that is, we're now realizing, pushing methane, you know, up to and beyond coal and its overall greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about all the efforts to turn the Pacific Northwest into a giant hub for exporting fossil fuels. And my guest is Dan Sears, who's the conservation director for the Columbia Riverkeeper. And we're talking right now about liquid natural gas export, which has been on the table here in Oregon for 10 years. Well, I want to talk about go back to Pembina and the coal terminals for a minute, because I got a little note from a caller just now who mentioned something that you said to me, Dan, before we went on the air, that even though Pembina looks like it's dead, there's still, it might be rearing its ugly head, and that even the coal terminal in Morrow might not be totally dead either. So what is it with these zombie terminals that just keep coming forward? It sounds like Oregon LNG is another case like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of our goal as a region has to be to send a strong message on all of them, because as soon as they get in, as soon as they get their toe in the door, it's very hard to get them back out. It takes clear action from a state or a federal agency to send a message that they won't be allowed to proceed with these projects. And that takes enormous political pressure. I mean, tens of thousands of people weighed in with the Department of State Lands and asked them to reject that permit for the Morrow Pacific project. And that's under appeal. And so we're dealing with, you know, that rejection. And now, you know, the company, Amber Energy, saying, well, we think that the state made a mistake and we think we actually deserve that permit, despite the fact that it would have this very negative impact on that area and the whole Columbia River. And they rejected it without ever really looking at the downstream part of that whole proposal, which was to barge coal from Boardman down to Port Westward and then load it from coal barges onto ocean-going ships. You know, I think our struggle is to stop them at every turn, because as soon as they're there, they'll, you know, they keep growing. These proposals keep growing.
Well, one example of kind of the petrostate tentacles that I saw with that was that the person who's in the head of the commission that voted against the coal terminal was then removed from office by Governor Kitzhaber. And that feels like that's kind of sort of set it, creating this sea of muck that Kate Brown is having to deal with now as governor.
Yeah, the Oregon Transportation Commission was looking at millions of dollars of public money, of lottery funds that were going to be allocated to basically rebuilding the dock that would be used to move coal from barges to ocean-going ships. And, you know, again, it was citizen pressure. It was people showing up to the hearings. The Oregon Transportation Commission has never had a hearing about Connect Oregon grants like the one they had last summer, where hundreds of people showed up and 5 hours of testimony. And that prompted the chair of that commission to say, I think this is a mistake. I think we need to look at the real impact of this project, not just, you know, what this dock rebuilding would do, but what we're moving with this dock. And for that, she was asked to resign by Governor Kitzhaber. And I would say Chair Mader is another heroic figure in this fight who really stood her ground. And even despite being asked to leave, once she left, she kept testifying at those hearings. And she was there the day that the Oregon Transportation Commission finally voted this spring to say no to that money that was going to be used for that coal dock.
Well, to me, that was actually one of the reasons why Kitzhaber should have left office as governor. And that didn't come out. A lot of the scandal around Kitzhaber was like, kind of who cares, Monica Lewinsky-ish kind of stuff. But what I got concerned about was some of these other backroom deals that he was dealing, that he was much more connected to the fossil fuel industry than Mr. Green, governor of sustainability. I mean, it was a real big contradiction.
And there was a real failed policy there when it comes to natural gas. And that came out very clearly. One of the governor's, Governor Kitzhaber's last actions as governor was the issuance of kind of a cover letter on the state's comments on the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal. And the comments from the agencies are very detailed and point out a lot of the flaws of the project. But there's a cover letter that's signed by the governor's natural resource director, Richard Whitman, that says, well, we think there's a real climate benefit potentially to using natural gas over coal. And we think if done correctly, this project could bring, you know, jobs and economic benefit to the region. And that's the precise position we need Governor Brown to redirect, to change. We can't afford to go through years and years more of dealing with these fossil fuel export proposals. We need to be moving in a different direction altogether. And I think it just reflects a lack of understanding about where the real climate impact is. You know, Oregon could move to windmills altogether tomorrow. And if we become a trafficker of coal, oil, natural gas, and propane, and we start shipping vast quantities of this stuff out through our state, what we do matters less and less. And that's something that really frustrated us as we, you know, kept pushing on LNG, is why are we hitting this brick wall? And why can't we get Governor Kitzhaber to understand that LNG is as bad or worse than coal for climate change?
Well, it seemed like he had some financial interests, actually.
Yeah, there's no question that Northwest Natural Gas is, you know, worked very hard to brand natural gas as a green form of energy. And what we've learned is that it just isn't. There's too much methane that gets released in the atmosphere, and that makes it a very potent greenhouse gas pollutant.
Well, getting back to some more of these zombie projects, even the Pembina project in Portland, I understand, is not quite dead.
That's right. Commissioner Fish has been looking into the possibility of asking their legal counsel for an opinion that would determine whether or not the city council would have to vote. If folks want to weigh in with Commissioner Fish, his phone number is 503-823-3589.
And get that again.
Yes, it's 503-823-3589. And we want to respectfully suggest that we think that's a bad idea. You know, Pembina had plenty of time to make its case. And, you know, we learned just at the end of this last week from that Ted Sickinger article that they weren't, or the port wasn't willing to pay that $6 million climate fee, which we think is totally absurd and not adequate for ameliorating the problems with the project. But Commissioner Fish needs to hear from all of us that we think Pembina deserve, they don't need any more favors from the city of Portland, and it's time for the project just to go away.
Well, I keep having this image of just seeing how little the oil and gas and coal industry really cares about what local communities want, that Seattle in a unified voice has said no to Shell to their bringing in their rig, the oil rigs that are going to go drill oil in the Arctic. And yet Shell just didn't care. They're in there now at the terminal up in the port of Seattle, I guess, getting fitted to go up to the Arctic. And that, I guess I heard from somebody that the city, the most they can do is like levy a maximum fine of $500 a day. That's the amount of clout they have.
Right.
So I think that that's another concern about what we want to, the door that we don't want to open.
Yeah, it is. And nothing could be a clearer example of that than LNG, where, you know, this company, for instance, Oregon LNG in Warrington, they came in and convinced a port commission to give them a lease, which the state agreed to, State of Oregon, Department of State Lands. And 10 years later, despite every effort to get them out and the community voting 5-0 against it and a referendum being run against LNG in the local county that stopped Rabbit LNG. And that was a 2/3 vote against LNG in a timber county, in a fishing county in Clatsop County. That's why we need to make an overwhelming case that the people of Oregon are going to stand in the way and not let it happen.
So what's happening tomorrow?
So tomorrow is a big day. For the first time in many years, we are getting people who are opposed to both the Oregon LNG project on the Columbia River and the Jordan Cove project in Coos Bay together in one place. We'll have people coming from every corner of Oregon, literally. People coming from as far away as Pendleton, Warrington, Vernonia, which just passed a resolution against LNG this past week, by the way. Congratulations to Vernonia against LNG. And then people coming up from Southern Oregon, all the way from Klamath Falls, Jackson County, Coquille, Coos Bay, and of course the folks from Douglas County. And then there are tons of people coming from Eugene and Corvallis and Salem and Portland.
Portland.
Yeah, and I should mention that there are carpools from Portland. I got a text from Bonnie McKinley, who's helping to put that together. For the east side, you can call Ted Singer at 503-781-2498. And for the west side carpool, you can call Bonnie at 503-705-1943. And people, we're expecting a big crowd, hundreds of people on the Capitol steps tomorrow. The keynote speaker is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. from the Waterkeeper Alliance. And he's going to be flanked by some really compelling Oregonians who are going to be speaking out against the project. Jody McCaffrey, who was on the radio earlier, is coming up from Coos Bay. She'll be speaking. Don West from the Cannery Pier Hotel in Astoria is coming to talk about the economic impact of LNG. And then Representative Peter Buckley is coming all the way up from Medford. Oh, of course, he's going to be in Salem, but he is coming from Medford to speak about his opposition to LNG. And then there are people coming from all of Oregon kind of share their stories. We're going to meet at the Capitol steps. People start gathering around 11:30, 12 noon, the rally begins in earnest. And then we're going to march to Department of State Lands. And there people will share their stories about why that's an agency that's really powerful. Landowners will speak to the fact that, you know, they wish they had the authority that DSL has to say no. Yet they can't say, you can't put that pipeline through my stream on my land, but you can. And here we're asking Director Abrams and that agency to say no. So it's going to be a full day, and it's going to be a lot of fun, and the weather's supposed to be great. So
I just wonder, you think you might get Kate Brown to come out, peek her head out from the Capitol, and respond to you?
So far, she said she can't do that. But a couple people from the rally are going in to meet with her, and we'll be delivering the message that we're sending to her. And we're very hopeful that she will take this opportunity to set a new direction for Oregon when it comes to fossil fuels. She's a new governor. She's not beholden to the failed policy that Governor Kitzhaber had on LNG and natural gas. She can set a different direction, and she can be the leader that saves these communities after 10 years, that frees these people. I mean, there are folks in Douglas County who have been dealing with a proposed pipeline in their land for 10 years. You know, that putting everything in limbo their entire lives, and who've devoted hundreds of hours, like Jody, you know, in Coos Bay's, countless hours to stopping these projects and protecting their community. We need a leader to stand up and do that, and we're asking Governor Brown to do it, and we think she's the woman to do it.
Well, it's really been good talking with you, Dan, and I hope that rally goes really well tomorrow.
Thank you.
And let's check back in a little while, in a few weeks, and see how things are going on the front and see what kind of impact the rally had.
And if people want more information and get connected with that rally, there's a website, www.nolngexports.org.
And it's on our website. I already put that on.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and all the information about the rally. So thanks a bunch, and we'll talk again really soon.
Thank you, Barbara.
We've been talking this morning with Dan Sarris, who's Conservation Director for Columbia River Keeper, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locustfocus. Next week, we'll talk with Janet Larson, who's co-author of The Great Transition, which is about the shift from fossil fuels to renewables. A very optimistic book, actually. I hope it's really true. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Steve Earle. Thanks for listening.
Come and gather round me, people, hand a tale to you I'll tell of my father and his father in the days before the spill. With an endless sky above them and a restless sea below, and every blessing flowing from the Gulf of Mexico. Well, my granddad worked the shrimp boats from the time he scrimped and saved and bought himself a trawler of his own. He was rough and he was ready, and he drank when he was home, and he made his family's living on the Gulf of Mexico.
And it's 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. Coming up, Grace Eagle Reed, and I believe she has Laura with her today. They are hosting Disability Awareness, a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities. You'll want to stay tuned at 11:30 on the Radio Zine. We speak with City Repair Corps managers Pretty Shaw and Rudy DeCruz about issues of placemaking, gentrification, equity, diversity, and multiculturalism within the sustainability movement, and about the upcoming village building convergence. Thank you, KBOO members, for your great support during our recent membership drive. If you missed it, you can still join. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.